Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Thomas Reed, correspondent for The Washington Post, commentator for National Public Radio's Morning Edition, documentary film producer for National Geographic Television, the A&E Network, and for the PBS program Frontline, Sick Around the World, India, A Second Opinion, and U.S. Healthcare, The Good News, as well as author of the best-selling book, The Healing of America. Mr. Reed was the chairman of the Colorado Foundation for Universal Healthcare, the statewide citizens' campaign working to pass Amendment 69, a ballot initiative to create Colorado Care, a state-based health plan that would have covered every resident of the state. The initiative was soundly defeated by a 4-1 margin in the November election. He'll speak today on the topic, how other industrialized nations managed to provide health care at half our cost. Mr. Reed's remarks were given as the keynote address for the inaugural Homecoming Interprofessional Program, sponsored by the Creighton University Health Sciences Department of Continuing Education. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, September 16, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Kirk Peck, chairman of the Department of Physical Therapy at the Creighton University School of Pharmacy and Health Professions.
Last year, I personally had the pleasure of hearing Mr. Reed address the topic of global health care as a keynote speaker during the American Physical Therapy Association State Government Payment and Policy Forum, which was held in Denver, Colorado. I found Mr. Reed's message on the state of health care in the United States, in contrast to other countries, alarming, and yet an inspirational story that needed to be shared with others to perpetuate his message for change. Mr. Reed's general curiosity led him to ponder, how is it possible for other free market industrialized democracies to provide high quality health care for society and yet spend significantly fewer dollars than the endeavor that's happening in the United States? To search for answers, Mr. Reed circled the globe twice. His in-depth reporting led to the national bestseller, The Healing of America, and two documentaries for PBS Frontline. Mr. Reed has found that it is not all socialized medicine outside the U.S., but rather many countries offer health care through the use of private physicians, hospitals, and insurance companies. Mr. Reed's rich experiences on global scale have provided insight into how other nations manage to successfully address the complexity of providing mass health care coverage for everyone. The answer as to why this phenomenon is predominantly evident only in other countries involves a unique moral commitment that the United States has failed to adopt. Please join me in welcoming Creighton University's inaugural homecoming interprofessional speaker, Mr. T.R. Reed. Mr. Reed.
Hi, everybody. There you go. Hi. Boy, I am delighted to be here. It's just great to be at this handsome university. I sent two of my kids to Jesuit schools, and they got a great education. So I just really like coming back to Creighton, and it's really exciting to be at this interprofessional program. Waiting to give this speech, I've met people who've been doctors and nurses in practice for 30 years, 40 years. And then we have the first year students here who are just getting started on a professional career. And I do have to say to the students, I have a feeling you're in for a long haul here because I'm really old. I just went to my 50th college reunion. We're all 72 years old. And all the guys, when I went there, it was all guys, who were, let's see, bankers, brokers, lawyers, business executives like that, they're all retired. The doctors, the nurses, and the PTs, they're all still working. And I asked my friend, Bill Leahy, my freshman roommate, I've known him 54 years, a wonderful guy, he's a neurologist. And I said, what are you doing? You know, we're old. Well, what are you working for? And he said, oh, man, I hate the insurance companies, I hate the billing, but you know, he says, you know, people come into my office every day as a neurologist, every day, and something hurts or something isn't working in their body, they're in pain or they're scared, and he says, you know, most of the time when they leave, they feel better. So why should I quit? Don't you see, he's helping other people, and that's what you're going to be doing for your whole career. So that's exciting. And for me, it's always great to come back to Omaha, particularly on a crisp, clear autumn day like this. I missed the storm yesterday, so fine for me. I first came to Omaha many, many years ago. I had a dear friend who grew up here, Deba Foxley. Her family were beef producers, and she got pretty high in kind of social circles in Omaha. And then she married a guy from Iowa. Is that okay? I guess it's okay. And her husband became a congressman. He was chairman of the banking committee. And they started traveling around to the world to these global meetings of, you know, finance ministers and stuff. And one of the places they went was this annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland. It's called the Billionaires Bazaar. And all the big shots of finance are there. And I guess at Davos, what they do is they assign you to a dinner table, and then you have to meet the others. So Deva told me she's sitting at this table, and the woman next to her is the finance minister of Italy, and the next guy runs the hospital system in France, and the next person is a professor at some university in Germany, and then there's this very elegant woman next to her, and she's Princess Caroline of the Netherlands, you know. And finally they get to Deva from Omaha, Nebraska, USA. And she says, well, in 1965, I was the queen of Exarban. I think it's her proudest moment. Do they still have Exarban? They still do this? Anyway. But my assignment today is to take us out of Omaha, to take us off of the Creighton campus, out of Nebraska, out of the United States. What we're going to do is we're going to take a very quick trip. They didn't give me much time, so I got to do this pretty fast, around the world to look at how other countries handle healthcare. And the whole point is to get us thinking about possibilities, to kind of open our minds, to see what we could learn by looking at other countries' healthcare systems. And there's a reason why we ought to do this. It's kind of a paradox. So in these first decades of the 21st century, in many ways, the United States is number one. We lead the world in so many areas. We're the strongest, richest, freest, most innovative country in the world. And in healthcare, we have a lot of strengths. We have the best medical schools, the best nursing and PT schools. We have the best hospitals. The United States is a world leader in medical innovation. All over the world, people are recovering from diseases and walking down the street because of American technology. So if you think about that, we ought to have the best healthcare system in the world. And the fact is, we don't. We don't. In fact, when you do the comparative studies, the Commonwealth Fund in New York does these studies, the United States turns out to be a third-rate power in this very important field of keeping people healthy. All the other countries like us, and I mean by that advanced, high-tech, free-market democracies, have better health outcomes, better recovery rates from diseases, longer life expectancy, lower neonatal mortality rates than the United States, and yet they spend about half as much as we do on average. So why is that? How come they can do better than the world's richest country? In many areas, we rank right near the bottom. The Commonwealth Fund has a measure called morbidities amenable to treatment. That is, if you're sick, does the system know how to treat your sickness and get you better? And among the 23 richest countries, the United States ranks 23rd in recovering from morbidities that people could recover from. And I'm going to try to explain to you why that is. It's not any problem with our doctors or hospitals. It's all the people who still can't get care in the world's richest country. So that's what I'm going to talk about, why the world's richest country ranks near the bottom. And I want you to just think about what we could do better. Maybe we could learn something from these other countries. There may be stuff they do we don't want to do, but maybe there's some ideas we could learn. I should point out, in the interest of full disclosure, I'm not an expert in this area. I'm not a healthcare economist. I'm not a doctor. I haven't worked for a hospital or an insurance company. I'm just a reporter. I'm just an ink-stained reporter who got interested in this topic. And, you know, reporters, we're pretty presumptuous. You know, we get interested in something, write a whole book about it. You know, that's how we work. I'll tell you what happened with me. I was a foreign correspondent for the Washington Post, and it was fun. It was good. Our family of five lived around the world, and it was exciting. It was. I remember the first week my first assignment was Japan. The first week my family lived in Tokyo, it's pretty exotic. I mean, it doesn't look like the United States, you know. And we were walking down the street. I was walking down the street with my three kids, and there's a guy with a stand on the street saying, "Taco, taco." And that's kind of weird, selling tacos in Tokyo. So I gave each of my kids 100 yen and go buy a taco. And my two little girls came running back and said, "Ooh, gross, disgusting, the most repulsive tacos I've ever seen." And what's going on here is, in Japanese, the word taco means octopus. And this gentleman was selling baby octopus on a toothpick. They like that there. And 100 yen is a bargain, in fact. And my son was 13, so he had one raw. I think it's the last one he ever had. But the girls were kind of... But it was kind of fun. It was interesting and fun to live there. I think living overseas made us better Americans. I'm sure of that. And I'll tell you why. When you're here, you can see the problems. We have some problems. Certainly, you look at our 2016 presidential campaign, you can see some problems. You get 10,000 miles away and look back, and the United States looks pretty good. You can see all the stuff that we've taken on and done better. And I think for my kids, particularly this e pluribus unum thing, where we've taken races and creeds and colors from all over the world and merged us into one society, and we haven't done it perfectly, but we've done it better than any other country. And I think my kids came home better Americans for that. So all that was good. I guess the downside, you could say, is one of my daughters constantly gets otitis media, earaches. My son fell off his skateboard in Tokyo and cracked his clavicle. What I'm getting at is we had to go to the doctor. And at first, we were worried about this. I mean, we're Americans. We know we do everything best, right? So we were a little wary about taking our children to a foreign doctor. And very quickly, we discovered in all the rich countries we lived in that the care was great, absolutely American standard. The facilities were fine. We didn't have to wait that long. But what was really striking were the bills. The bills were 1/10, 1/20 what you would pay in the United States for the same treatment. I was really struck by this. In fact, when we lived in Japan, quite often I didn't bother to send the doctor bill home to the insurance company in Washington because the postage was more than the doctor bill, really. So that was quite striking to me. So just as a reporter, I got interested in this. How do they provide such good care and decent facilities at such low cost? And I went around the world and wrote a book about this topic of how do they do it, and made a couple of movies. And so what we're going to do today is, first I should point out, I thought this was going to be a pretty mechanical book. How do you set up a system to do it? And I realized very quickly that there was another important question. That's just not just how do you cover everybody, but why do you cover everybody? Because all those other countries have made the commitment to provide health care for everybody. There's only one industrialized country that doesn't provide health care for everybody, and that's the world's richest country, the United States. Even with the Obamacare expansion, according to the Congressional Budget Office last week, we have 32 million people in our country without health insurance. And when I went around the world, I asked health ministers and economists and prime ministers, why do you cover everybody? And their first answer is, why don't you? You know, and you think about that, why don't we? So anyway, that's what I got into. And so what I'm going to do today is we're going to take a very, they didn't give me much time here, so we're going to take a very quick trip around the world and take a look at how these other countries manage to do it, and then we'll ask the question why as well. I think it's not a coincidence that I first got interested in this when we were living in Japan, because going to the doctor in Japan is rather pleasant. They make it rather pleasant. So, you know, Japan is a rich, developed country. You go to the doctor's office. It looks like going to the doctor's office in Omaha, Nebraska. You know, you go into a reception room. Somebody checks you in. Then you wait to see the doctor. There's a National Geographic on the table. You know, it's pretty familiar. And then the difference is, in America, you know, under our privacy rules, they can't say your last name in the hospital. So the receptionist comes out, and she says, "Tom, is there a Tom here? Tom, yeah, that's me, Tom." Pretty casual, pretty American. In Japan, it's kind of the same thing, but the receptionist comes out and says, "Tomaso Rito-sama, irashaimasu ka? Tomaso Rito-sama, irashaimasu ka?" And that means, "Has the highly honorable Thomas Reed graced us with his presence today?" You know, you feel better before you even see the doctor. So I think that's how I got started. So what I'm going to do is take you around the world and talk about what I found. First, I think I'll tell you what I didn't find, because in many ways that's just as important for Americans. First, as Scott said, it's not all socialized medicine out there. As I will explain to you, some countries run medicine out of the government, but many countries, many rich democracies, cover everybody with private doctors, private hospitals, and private insurance. In fact, many rich democracies have less government involvement than the United States, and yet they manage to cover everybody. Guess what? I did not find a perfect system. Every country I went to has problems. Every country I went to has these stories about some poor patient left on a gurney in the hospital. Nobody's got it down perfect. And all the countries are struggling with the same issues that we are. How to deal with the miracles of modern medicine. They fight pain, they combat disease, but they're very expensive. And everybody in all countries is trying to figure out how to deal with that problem. And then interestingly, I found out they all face the same questions. The questions facing a healthcare system are roughly the same everywhere. They don't all come up with the same answers because each country's healthcare system reflects its history and its culture. For example, I'll give you an example. Most of the other countries, which cover everybody, also provide prescription drugs in the system. And like our insurance companies, they have what they call a formulary. They have a list of approved drugs. And if your drug, the drug you need, is on the list, it's free or very cheap. And if it's not on the list, you can still get it, but you have to pay. And so in my book, I spend some time on this question of which countries have decided to provide Viagra for free. Yeah, why would they do that? And one of the places they've done this is Great Britain. And I lived in Britain. I was in the National Health Service, which is a good healthcare system, but kind of stingy. There's a lot of stuff they won't do. They won't give you an annual physical. There are just a lot of things the NHS would not do that Americans would normally do. But in Britain, they have Viagra on their list of free drugs. Now, why do you think the Brits have done that? I think I know what you're thinking, but that's not the reason. No. The reason is, did you know this? A British scientist invented Viagra. You know, we have rocket scientists and brain surgeons. They have boffins. And one of their boffins invented Viagra. His name is Richard Sessions. Today, he's Sir Richard Sessions because the Queen knighted him for this service to humanity. And they're proud of their boffin, so his pill is on their list. But you go 25 miles away across the channel, and in France, Viagra is not on the approved list, right? And I'm a reporter. I went around the world looking at healthcare systems, and I had this checklist of standard questions, right? So I'm in the health ministry in Paris going down my checklist, and I say, and why don't you have Viagra on your formulary? And this woman says, Si franchement, they do not need a Viagra, she says. So anyway, I'm going to take you around the world, and I'm going to try to be an objective reporter. I'll tell you what works in these other countries and what doesn't work. None of them is perfect. I think, you know, they cover everybody and spend less. They have better outcomes. I think in many ways they're better, but they're not perfect. And since I'm just going to be an objective reporter here and try to lay it on the line. And since I'm going to be frank and objective, I'll also tell you my hidden agenda, what the heck, why I really came to Omaha today. So here's the thing. They didn't give me much time. I really have to do this very quickly. I can just skip over the surface. So my hope is that some of you will say, gee, that was pretty interesting. I wonder if there's a book I could buy about that. That's okay, so let's start our world tour. We'll start our tour in Great Britain with this terrific guy, Lord William Beveridge. He's what the British call titled gentry. He was born to a seat in the House of Lords. And some of those, you know, they have lords and earls and marquesses and barons. They have all that stuff in Britain. Some of them never do anything, but Lord Beveridge is kind of the paradigm case of the good lord. He really took his life in good directions. He graduated from Oxford in 1903. He'd grown up in enormous wealth. And the day he graduated, he went down to the streets of East London and dedicated his life to helping the poor, what he called the other half. In his memoir, he called him the other half. And here's what he found. He found men who wanted to work, but they were homesick or they were lame, and of course, no health care. They couldn't work. He found children who wanted to go to school and get an education, but they were home in bed, and there's no health care, no medication. They couldn't go to school. He found women who were terrified to get pregnant because their sister or their cousin had died in pregnancy with no health care. And he dedicated his life to helping those people, to try to provide social services for those people. And then what happened is, in about 1943 or so, in the middle of World War II, Winston Churchill was the prime minister, and he was a forward-looking statesman. And the war was still raging against the Nazis, but Churchill saw by then that the U.S. and the U.K. were going to defeat the Nazis. Britain would emerge from the war as an independent country. And so he started thinking about what kind of country should Great Britain be after World War II. He wanted to design Britain for the next century after the war ended. And he appointed all these blue ribbon commissions, and he appointed the great Lord Beveridge to look into social services in Britain. And Beveridge published a famous report in 1945, you could tell he was still thinking about those sick children in East London, because most of that report is about health care. And he decided that providing care for people's health, keeping people healthy, should be government's job. It's a government service, just like paving the streets or putting out fires or running the public library. It's a service you get from government when you need it, and you don't get a bill. Just like you don't get a bill when you use the library, you don't get a bill when you go to the doctor in Britain. They pay. They pay for health care, and they pay through taxes, and the taxes are high. The sales tax on everything you buy in Britain is 20%. But in return, they get a healthcare system that's free at the point of service, no healthcare premium, no deductible, no copay, no bill. That's what they get for the service. In the British model of this, government owns the hospitals. The doctors, lab technicians, nurses who work in the hospitals are government employees. In the British system, the GPs, the family doctor, is a private enterprise, but she only bills the National Health Service. She doesn't bill her patients. So this is government-run, government-paid health care, and it worked pretty well. When my family was there, it worked fine. The doctor, my daughter would get an earache, and the doctor comes to your house. She says, "Oh, I believe a penicillin jab would be effective. Yeah, give her a shot of penicillin." And she treats your daughter, and then guess what? She walks out. No bill, no copay, no deductible. I kind of liked it, you know. And the Brits have somewhat better health statistics than the United States, and they spend per capita 44% as much as we do for health care in a system that covers everybody. So this is a model that works, and therefore it's been copied a lot. It's used in Spain, Italy, Austria, all of Scandinavia, New Zealand, Cuba is a classic example of the Beveridge model of healthcare, and it works pretty well. So let me ask you a question. Here's your quiz question. You ready? We're at a college. Here's your quiz. Is this socialized medicine? Yeah, I ask this all the time, and I get this kind of befuddled look because we don't know what socialized medicine is, Americans. We know it's bad. We just don't know what it is. But I would answer yes. I think if the government provides the care and the government pays for the care, that's what people say is socialized medicine when they dump on socialized medicine. But I don't want you to go away thinking this is the only way to provide health care for everybody, because we're now going to jump over to the mainland of Europe and see the mirror image of the Beveridge model. This is the Bismarck model, named for this warm and fuzzy-looking gentleman, Otto von Bismarck. He's the George Washington of Germany. In 1871, he merged about 25 German-speaking fiefdoms and principalities in the heart of Europe into a new country. He called it Deutschland, the land of the German speakers. We call it Germany, which was the Roman name for that part of Europe. And he was, well, you can see, he was a Prussian general. He was, he's what we would call a Republican. He was small government, low tax, big military, and a pro-business kind of guy. And when he started this new country, he really did it using the threat of his army. But once Germany was started, he faced a pretty delicate question that he couldn't answer with military power. And here's what it was. He now had the biggest country in Europe, but the citizens of it didn't think of themselves as Germans. They were still Frankfurters or Bavarians or Weimaraners or Alsatians. They didn't see an allegiance to this new country and its new capital in Berlin. And that was his task, to create a sense of allegiance and belonging. And you know how he did it? He invented the welfare state. He invented the notion that central government should give benefits to everybody in the country, and then people would feel an allegiance and a belonging to that capital in that country. He started out with old age pensions. When you retired from the farm or the factory, the government in Berlin would send you a check every month so you didn't fall into poverty. We call that idea Social Security. We got around to it in 1935, but he started it. And then in 1883, Bismarck came up with his nuttiest idea yet. He said we should provide health care for everybody. This is at a time when maybe 15% of the people in Germany could afford to go to the doctor. Health care was a luxury for the rich. And Bismarck said, we got to provide health care for everybody. Well, why did he do it? He was the biggest manufacturing power in Europe. He needed healthy people to man the factory. He had the biggest army. He needed healthy young men to man his army. But he also said, he's a soldier, but he was a good Lutheran. He went to church every Sunday of his life. And he said, you know, I learned from childhood that we're obliged to care for the least of our brethren. And if we don't do it when they're sick, we're not meeting our basic moral obligation. So it was really a moral imperative that drove Bismarck to do this. But as I said, he was a small government guy. He didn't want to do it through the government. So the Bismarck model still exists today in Germany. Everybody has to buy insurance from a private insurance company. There are about 220 of them in Germany. The docs are private. About 99% of the hospitals are private. There are some university hospitals, but otherwise private. You remember I told you that some countries have less government involvement than the United States. In Germany, there's no Medicare. That's our federal system for older patients. There's no Medicaid. That's the government system for poor people. In Germany, everybody is on private insurance, cradle to grave. If you're too poor to pay the premium, the government steps in and pays it for you. But this is a private system, and it works pretty well. Germany covers 82 million Germans, about 16 million aliens, much better health statistics than the United States, and they spend about 62 to 65% as much per capita as we do. And therefore, countries that are into capitalism, that like the private sector, have copied this. So this is used in, the same model is used in Switzerland, Belgium, Netherlands, Japan. Japan is a classic Bismarck country. In my book, I call Japan Bismarck on rice, because they just took the system and dumped it on there. So here's your quiz question. Is this socialized medicine? I think the answer is no. No, it's private. It's the insurers and the doctors are regulated by the health ministry, but this is a private system, and it works fine. It works fine. Everybody's required to be covered and to pay. And in Germany, if you don't sign up for health insurance, they assign you to a company and you get the bill every month. If you don't pay your bill, they garnish your wages. I mean, they're pretty serious about this, but that makes it work. So I showed you one model, the beverage model, pretty much all government. This model, the Bismarck model, is pretty much private. The third model we're going to look at is a marriage of the two. And the economists call this the national health insurance model. You know, I'm a reporter. Reporters are into people, so I call it the Douglas model after this great guy, Tommy Douglas. Tommy Douglas was a Baptist minister in Saskatchewan, Canada. It's a sort of a, well, it's Nebraska, you know. It's a Midwestern wheat-growing, corn-growing province in the center of Canada. And he was a Baptist minister in the 1930s and 40s. And Saskatchewan was, you know, it was Nebraska, it was North Dakota, it was Kansas. It was a Republican conservative wheat-growing place, very conservative. The Tories won every election, the conservatives. And in 1940, this man ran for governor on the socialist ticket. He ran for governor on the socialist ticket. They call it premier, but it's governor. And he won. So how did a socialist win in this Republican conservative province? And the reason is he promised in 1940 that he would provide health care for everybody in Saskatchewan. Nobody in Canada has this. It had it. It was a wacky idea. But people wanted it because there, too, only about 15% of the people had any form of health insurance. And he said, I'm going to provide health care for everybody. He won. He passed it. Very quickly, it worked in the 1940s. Very quickly, the two neighboring provinces, Alberta and Manitoba, saw that it worked and copied it. And by 1961, it had spread to all of Canada. Even the snob big shots in Ontario and Quebec copied it. People like him for this. You know, the Canadian system, it doesn't work that great. I'll tell you that in a minute. But it treats everybody the same. And in Canada, that's the primary national value. I'd say for Americans, we're into liberty and individual freedom. That's what really matters to us, liberty and justice for all. In Canada, the most important thing is egalitarianism, treating everybody the same. And everybody likes this system because it treats everybody the same. In 2000, for the millennium, the Canadian Broadcasting Company had a poll to pick the greatest Canadian in history. And Wayne Gretzky was on the list. Pierre Trudeau, who was there, JFK, was on the list. Alexander Graham Bell, he was born in Toronto, as it turns out. Tommy Douglas won, greatest Canadian in history, because he created this healthcare system that they really like. He was a good politician, and he came up with a good name for this model that he created. Do you know what he called it? Medicare. He named it Medicare in 1944. And sure enough, in 1965, when our president, Lyndon Johnson, decided that we needed to provide health care for all our seniors, he took the name Medicare and the model, that is public payment of private doctors, from Canada. And as I said, the way this works is everybody is required to pay in every month to a public health insurance, a government health insurance plan. And then that public insurance plan pays private doctors and private hospitals. So it's kind of a mix of what we saw before. The payment system is public. The providers are largely private in Canada. So this is a model that also works pretty well. It works pretty well, and it's been copied broadly. Let's see, Brazil, Australia, Taiwan, South Korea have copied this Canadian model. And as I said, there are 54 million Americans on Medicare using the Canadian model. So it works okay. It doesn't work that well in its home country. Have you heard about long waiting lists and restricted choice in Canada? That's true. I argue in my book that the reason is they're just too stingy. They don't want to spend enough on healthcare. They're spending about 9% of their GDP on healthcare. The U.S. is spending 17%, and we still have 30 million people uninsured. So they need to spend a little more to make this system work. But basically, in other countries, Australia, for example, uses their model, and they have shorter waiting times for both elective and acute treatment than the United States. So this can work. So here's my quiz question. Is this socialized medicine? Quasi-socialized medicine? I mean, is the government insurance plan semi-socialized medicine? Yeah, semi-socialized. No, I'm going to answer this question. The answer has to be no. No, this could not be socialized medicine. It's just a matter of simple logic. I know this is true for simple logic. I know this can't be socialized medicine for this reason. Americans love Medicare, and Americans hate socialized medicine, right? So, okay. So I've shown you three models very quickly. I just had to breeze over. These models only exist in the world's rich countries because providing health care is really something that only rich countries can do. In most of the world's 200 countries, the health care system is what the economists call the out-of-pocket model, and it's exactly what it says. It is, if your child is sick and you have some money in your pocket to pay a doctor, she gets treated. If you have no money, she stays sick or she dies. This is the fact of life. This is the way things work in most of the world today, the out-of-pocket model. If you don't have money, well, maybe you can pay with something else. I went to this pretty remote clinic in northern Nepal up by Mount Everest. There are no roads there. You walk everywhere. And we walked maybe an hour and a half up this steep hill, and on top of the hill is this squat little square building. It looked like a garden shed or something. Stucco building. The only thing about it was all the walls were a different color. I didn't figure that out. And that was the local clinic for about 100-square-mile area. And people take their, you know, they walk up there or carry their sick child up to the doctor. And I was inside talking to the doctor. I said, "Doctor, do your patients pay you?" He said, "Well, yeah, some people have money. A few people have money. But everybody wants to pay. You know, there's some element of respect in paying for the services you receive. So how do they pay you?" And he said, "Well, I eat a lot of potatoes because that's the staple crop in that part of the world. Everybody grows potatoes in the garden. And so when they walk up that hill to the clinic, they carry their sick child in one hand and 10 kilos of potatoes in the other, and that's how they pay him." And he also told me, "You know, sometimes people say to me, 'Doc, I don't have any money to pay you, but I do want to pay you. So, you know what, back home I have some paint. I'll come back and paint your clinic.'" And everybody has a different color. So that's how you end up with that thing. And so that's the out-of-pocket model. So I had to do this very quickly. But what I've given you in this world tour is the four models of healthcare. I did it fast. It took me a long time. I'm not that quick a learner. It took me a long time to figure this out. I first went around the world writing my book for Penguin. It was expensive. Penguin had to pay for that. And while I was doing it, I had made some movies for PBS Frontline, you know, their documentary show. And I mentioned it to the producers there, and they said, "Oh, that would make a great movie." So then we went back around the world and made this movie for PBS. I went pretty much to the same doctors and the same people a second time. It was fine. And, of course, PBS is funded by viewers like you, so you bought me dinner in Paris, and I'm grateful. But here's the secret. This is just between you and me. Don't tell the accountants at PBS. But here's the deal. Guess what? I could have seen all four models and never left home. I could have seen them all right here, because right here in the world's richest country, we've got them all. If you're a senior on Medicare, well, those people live in Canada for healthcare purposes. If you're a veteran like me, or active duty military, or in the Indian Health Service, well, they live in England for healthcare purposes. They go to a government hospital and see government doctors. That's the British system right here, the Beveridge model. 19 million Americans are on it. If you're sharing the cost of private insurance with your employer, that's about 150 million Americans. You're on the they live in Germany. That's the Bismarck model of healthcare. And for the 32 million Americans with no health insurance at all, well, they live in Afghanistan or Angola or India. If they live in a big city, there's probably a free hospital they can go to, or a federally qualified health center where they can line up for care. But basically, those people, 30 million of them, are on the out-of-pocket model. We've got them all. And that is the fundamental difference between the United States and all the other countries. All the other countries have decided everybody, for health care, everybody should be treated the same. Everybody should be treated the same. In the same way that we give everybody an education, we give everybody one vote, we don't allow rich peoples to buy their own jury. They take the jury the system provides. They have the same attitude towards health care. Everybody should be in the same system and have the same access to health care, and that's the fundamental difference. And the reason they do that is because they see this moral imperative to care for others. And, you know, the United States is a pretty moral country, a very religious country, and yet we have never made this commitment. So I feel we should provide health care for everybody, and I know we could. I know we could because all the other countries like us have already done it. In fact, anybody want to leave early? I can reduce my whole argument here to a bumper sticker. Are you ready? If France can do it, the United States can do it. That's my whole argument right there. So how are we going to get there? Because the United States always does the right thing eventually. We will get to universal health care. I don't think it's going to happen on a national basis. Anybody here think Washington, D.C. can fix our health care system? Yeah, they laugh. If you look at our presidential campaign, we really haven't seen much. The Republican candidates, there were 16 of them, they all wanted to repeal Obamacare, and they kind of stopped there. They didn't really have plans. Bernie Sanders wanted Medicare for all. I personally think that would work, but it's not going to pass. Hillary Clinton says she favors universal health care eventually. She doesn't say when we're going to get there. And Donald Trump has a health plan. Do you know it? I have it right here. I'll tell you Donald Trump's health plan. Are you ready? My health plan will be so great it'll make your head spin. So I don't see a national solution. I'm quoting him. I think the way we're going to get there is state by state. I think one or two or three states will try a system to provide health care for everybody. Maybe a couple of them will screw it up. Somebody will make it work, and then the other states will copy. And in a federal system, this is a tried and true way to bring about change in the United States. If you look at our history, a lot of the most important ideas started in one state: free public education, female suffrage, child labor laws, minimum wage laws, interracial marriage was illegal in most of the United States when I was a child. And one or two states said, let's do it. And of course, recreational marijuana started in one state, my state, Colorado, I'm proud to say. We're the highest state in the country in more ways than one. So in the same, and now seven states have legalized marijuana, and it's on seven ballots this fall, and I think it's going to pass on all of them. These ideas, when people see that they work, copy them, and I think what's going to happen is one state is going to come up with a plan that works, and I will now predict to you that the one that's going to do it this November is my state of Colorado, because we have put an initiative on the ballot, we call it Colorado Care, to create a cooperative health plan in our state that will cover everybody, cover every resident of Colorado. And at the moment, we're ahead in the polls. I'm not sure we can win it. There's a lot of opposition. There's a lot of support. But please watch in November to see if we can pass this thing. Because if we do, I'd like to see Nebraska go next. If we don't, I'd like to see Nebraska go next. I think this is what we're going to do. Because what I found when I went around the world is there are a lot of different ways to provide health care for everybody. It doesn't have to be big government. It doesn't have to be all private. Either of those works. The most important thing is to make the commitment to provide health care for everybody, which we have never done. And once we as Americans decide, doggone it, we're a rich, decent country, we want everyone who's sick to have access to a doctor, well, we're Americans. We can do it. So let's get it done. Thank you.
What?
What a wonderful talk. It's so wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Reed, for coming and joining us in this inaugural event to do this. We have time for just a question or two or three from the audience, and we have a couple mics, folks with mics that are going around. If you have a question and want to raise your hand, perfect. We will.
Hi. Thank you. Hi. What a great talk.
Thanks.
In the countries using the German model where they have private hospitals and insurance companies, are they for-profit versus non-profit? And do you think that matters in terms of the way, how well it works?
Yeah. What I found in other countries is many countries have private insurance. Nobody has for-profit health insurance. It's only the United States. And the doctors, the hospitals, the labs, the drug companies, they can be for-profit, but all the other countries have decided that health insurance should be a charity, basically. So in Germany, as I said, there are 220 of them. In Japan, there are 3,000 different insurance companies, but they're nonprofit. They exist to pay people's doctor bills.
Hi, thank you for a very provocative lecture. I have a question for you. Why do you think that Americans agree with mandatory car insurance, which in essence you have to carry at least liability insurance, but are so adamantly against mandatory health insurance? Is a car wreck bad, but a health wreck okay for families and society?
I agree. I agree with the premise of your question. Same for fire insurance. You know, when you buy a house and get a mortgage, the bank requires that you have fire insurance. All the other countries require that everybody be in the system. And when we passed the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, they too put in a mandate to buy insurance, but Congress wimped out. They set a very low penalty. The penalty for next year for not having health insurance is $695 for the year. I mean, that's like 1 or 2 months' health insurance premium. So a lot of people have made the economic decision not to buy. But I agree with you. I think the way insurance works is everybody pays in. And yes, that means young, healthy people are paying in and not going to the doctor. Guess what? If you're young and healthy today, it's not going to last. You're going to get old. You're going to have to go to the doctor. And then young, healthy people will be helping offset your insurance costs. So I'm with you.
At a university, and of course, our students pay a very high price to have such a great education.
Yeah.
A lot of these countries that you're comparing us to subsidize a lot of the education so the students don't come out of their training with huge loans. Does that affect the cost of health care, and how can we get away from this model in the U.S.?
Yes, that is absolutely right. Almost all the other countries, medical education is free. PTs, nurses, doctors, they're not charged for their education. Canada does charge, but, you know, like a tiny fraction of what we charge. And that makes a big difference because these docs go out, you know, you graduate with $200,000 a day. You got to do something about it. It's going to dog you for years. I think this is a really stupid policy on the part of the United States. For about one half of what percent of what we pay for health insurance, we could pay every med student and every nursing student's tuition. I think it would be much smarter, but we've never done it that way. Yes, ma'am.
Well, it sounds so ideal. I love the idea that everyone should have it. I think it's really unrealistic for America, mainly because we have all the lobbyists, we have so much fraud, we have so many pharmaceutical people that pay to push their drugs. I mean, it sounds wonderful, but if we pass that in Colorado, it'll be a killer.
Because
20% tax on everybody?
In Colorado?
In Colorado.
No, our tax is a 3.3% tax on the worker and a 6% tax on the employer.
When that passes, if that 69 passes, it'll be like 20%. Won't it?
No, go on our website. It's coloradocare.org. I'm not going to make the pitch here, but you can see what it costs. It doesn't cost 20%.
So you don't think there's a lot of fraud and stuff that's involved in America that
There's definitely, she asked about, there's fraud in every healthcare system because there are trillions of dollars pouring into healthcare systems. Somebody's going to cheat on all of them, that's true. So you have to police the fraud. I don't think there will be any more in Colorado than there would be anywhere else. Thank you.
How do the different systems handle malpractice liability?
Yeah.
And how does that affect the cost of care?
Yeah, this is important. Every country has this problem of patients who are injured in a doctor's office or a hospital. Sometimes it's just an accident. This is very highly technical work. And sometimes it's negligence. And so there are two problems. You have to compensate the patient who is injured, and sometimes you have to discipline the doctor. Everybody has to deal with this. Nobody does it through the tort law system the way the United States does. It's just not a smart way to do it because what we have is we have lots of the money in that system going to lawyers and judges and experts rather than to the patient. You have lay juries making pretty technical medical decisions. So the other countries do it in a different way. In Britain, they have a board that determines all the acceptable procedures for any treatment, and if the doctor can show that she followed the procedure, there's no lawsuit. Germany, they do it in an interesting way. In Germany, every 2 years, a doctor and your specialist from another part of the country comes to your office and reads all the files and reads all the letters of complaint. And if that other doctor thinks that this doc screwed up, then she gets disciplined and the patient gets compensated. So everybody has to deal with this. Nobody does it the American way. But I have to say, does it impact the cost of care? The big study at Johns Hopkins said it added about 1% to the cost of care. Well, 1% of a $6 trillion industry is a lot of money, but you know, it's 1%. We ought to do something about it. I feel it's a big failing of Obamacare that they didn't even touch the malpractice system. And no other country would do it our way. So I think that's something we ought to fix.
Question here on your left.
I think we probably have enough money in the system, but we'd have to re-educate American consumers. An extraordinarily large percentage of healthcare is delivered with minimal effects. I'm talking about end-of-life care, transplants on older people, which aren't done in other countries. These invert the pyramid, and if we could educate consumers not to do this, we'd have enough money right now to provide all that free care, I think.
Yeah, we definitely have enough money in our system to provide care for everybody. As I said, we spend twice as much per capita as all the countries that do cover everybody. And part of the problem is the very high cost of the last 6 months or sometimes 1 month of life. For many people, a large percentage of people, more is spent on their health in the last 3 months of their life than in the previous 75 years. That's really true. One of the best ways to deal with this is an American invention, hospice, where we say to people, look, you're coming to the end. You've had a good life. It's not worth it for you or for us to keep fighting. That's been a good solution, and it's spread around the world. All I can tell you is no country has solved this problem. Some countries have rules. If you said in Britain, after age 89, they won't give you renal dialysis, right? And you're going to die. And guess what happens? That's the guideline. And guess what happens? Some spunky, energetic grandma who hikes 5 miles a week or something has renal failure, and her grandchildren go to the member of parliament and say, well, grandma, she's got 10 more years in her. Give her. And they do. It turns out to be very hard to enforce those rules. So I think the better solution, as you say, is changing the mindset and convincing people that hospice is a very good way to deal with end of life rather than spending those months in the operating room.
I'd like to focus on the 32 million that you indicate are uncovered by any kind of insurance.
Yeah.
Are our results in mortality, morbidity as a results-oriented person by those uncovered population as opposed to the rest of the population that's covered by one scheme or another?
Yes, that's exactly right. As I said, in all the comparative studies, we rank near the bottom among the rich nations. And the reason is not the people who get care or go to our great hospitals. They do great. The people is all the people who don't get care. For example, the Commonwealth Institute in New York does an annual study on neonatal mortality. That means how many children die before their first birthday. Of the 23 richest countries in terms of keeping children alive till their first birthday, the United States ranks 23rd last, which is kind of shocking. And it's not because of the hospitals or the OBGYNs or the pediatricians. They're great. It's all the women who get no care during their 9 months of pregnancy, and then those babies are born very sick. So the issue for the United States, the reason we rank low compared to other countries is all the people who aren't covered. If you get health care in America, you're doing fine. But it's all the tens of millions that we don't provide adequate care for that bring our national statistics down, and it's just wrong. We ought to provide health care for them. That's my view.
We have time for one more quick one, and then we'll...
For the countries that are following the Beveridge or the Douglas models,
yeah.
Are there any estimates of their healthcare fraud rate relative to ours?
All countries have healthcare fraud. And the reason is, as I said, there's tons of money flowing through the system, and it's got to be pretty tempting to copy. And I don't know the exact numbers, but I don't think they're much... I don't think ours are vastly worse. I mean, we have trillions of dollars. It's a $6 trillion industry in America, so people cheat on it. But I think people cheat in all countries, and you find examples of that. I don't know the numbers, but it's just too tempting. You know, I wrote a book about how honest the Japanese are. You know, they don't kill each other. They have very low crime rates. And when I was in Japan working on my film, they just prosecuted some doctor who went out on the street and found poor people and got them to sign a document saying they got a $5,000 operation, which they didn't in Japan. I mean, that's a pretty honest country. So everywhere, when there's big tons of money flowing around, people are going to cheat on it, unfortunately, and you just have to police that to go after it. I think in every country that's a problem. So, I'm so grateful to you for coming. Have a great interprofessional weekend. Welcome back to Omaha. Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Thomas Reed, correspondent for The Washington Post, commentator for National Public Radio's Morning Edition, documentary film producer for National Geographic Television, the A&E Network, and for the PBS program Frontline, Sick Around the World, India, A Second Opinion, and U.S. Healthcare, The Good News, as well as author of the best-selling book, The Healing of America. Mr. Reed was the chairman of the Colorado Foundation for Universal Healthcare, the statewide citizens' campaign working to pass Amendment 69, a ballot initiative to create Colorado Care, a state-based health plan that would have covered every resident of the state. The initiative was soundly defeated by a 4-1 margin in the November election. He spoke today on the topic, how other industrialized nations managed to provide health care at half our cost. Mr. Reed's remarks were given as the keynote address for the inaugural Homecoming Interprofessional Program, provided by the Creighton University Health Sciences Department of Continuing Education. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, September 16, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.